Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling, well, a really fascinating career arc, someone who just doesn't fit the typical Hollywood mold, the incredibly intense and often quiet Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, it's definitely more than just a standard career path, isn't it? It's almost like a deliberate study in artistic integrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, his recent success with Oppenheimer, wow, that huge awards sweep, the Oscar, the BAFTA, Golden Globes, it feels sudden to some people, maybe.
Right, like he just appeared.
Exactly. But it's really the peak, the absolute culmination of, what, 3 decades of work. Work marked by incredible range, really deep stage roots, and something we have to keep coming back to, this very deliberate privacy.
Absolutely. And for this deep dive, we've gathered, well, extensive sources. We're looking at his whole professional history, even bits of his personal life, to understand how this reserved artist who, you know, actually wanted to be a rock star.
Which is amazing in itself.
It is. How he navigated from that, through theater, indie films, playing supervillains, iconic TV roles, to finally reaching this like ultimate critical acclaim as the lead in a massive global blockbuster.
So our mission for you, the listener, is to kind of break down the key moments, the pivotal stages of this journey. We really want to spotlight the specific projects, yeah, but maybe more importantly, the personal choices. Mm-hmm. The decisions he made that reveal who he is as an actor, someone who just thrives on transformation, but actively avoids that whole celebrity machine.
Yeah, that tension you mentioned, the drive for challenging work versus the total avoidance of fame that comes with it. That seems to be the core thing we're exploring here.
It really is. So let's dive in right at the start. Cork and the life he almost chose.
Okay, so Cork, Ireland, born May 25th, 1976, grew up in Douglas, then Ballintemple. And the sources really paint this picture of a family deeply rooted in, well, education.
Oh, completely. You could almost call it the family business, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
His mother talked French. His father was with the Department of Education. And it didn't stop there. Grandfather, aunts, uncles, all teachers. It's quite a legacy.
And he attended Presentation Brothers College, which is a fee-paying Catholic school. But it sounds like there was some friction there early on.
Yeah, definitely. Academically, he was apparently quite successful, did well. But he also admitted he got into trouble a fair bit, you know, even got suspended. He felt the school really prioritized sports over everything else.
And the artistic side, the stuff he was drawn to, got neglected.
Pretty much, yeah. That neglect sort of created a space, I think. And his first escape wasn't even acting. It was music. But there's this one key moment, this little spark of drama came from outside the school curriculum.
The Corkadorka Theater Company thing.
Exactly. A drama module run by their director, Pat Kiernan. And Murphy himself described that experience. It was like a switch flicking. He called it a huge high, feeling fully alive. That really grabbed him.
And his English teacher, William Wall, who's actually a novelist, encouraged him too. But still, at this point, acting wasn't the main plan, right? It was all about the music.
Absolutely. Rockstar dreams. He started young, writing songs, performing from about age 10. And he had this band with his younger brother, Petey.
The Sons of Mr. Green Jeans. I love that name.
It's brilliant, isn't it? After Frank Zappa. Apparently, they were obsessed with the Beatles. And the sources say they specialized in wacky lyrics and endless guitar solos.
That's like fun.
Yeah. It does. But here's the really crucial part, the bit that feels like a preview of his whole career philosophy. They got close, like really close to making it.
Yeah, they were offered a 5-album deal, Acid Jazz Records. Just imagine if he'd signed that in his late teens, his whole life would have been completely different.
It's a massive what if, but they turned it down. Right. Why? Well, a couple reasons. Partly practical piety. His brother was still in school, which was a big factor. But also, and this is key, they really disagreed with the terms. Especially the money offered for Murphy's compositions.
Yeah.
It felt like they'd be signing away all the rights, you know.
And that right there, even as a teenager, tells you so much. It's not just a funny story about a band. It's the first clear sign of this, like, fierce need for autonomy, for creative control.
Absolutely. He was, what, 19?
Yeah.
And willing to walk away from a potentially life-altering deal because he didn't want to be locked in, didn't want to lose ownership. He said later he was relieved they didn't sign.
What did he say exactly?
Something like it would have meant signing away your life to a label and the whole of your music. You see that distrust of the industry machine right from the start. And that philosophy, this sort of guarding of his own creative space, you see it again and again later on. Right up to him starting his own production company recently.
Okay, so music nearly happened. But before acting really took hold, there was another path he tried briefly. Law school.
Uh-huh. University College Cork, UCC. Started in 96. Lasted all of 1 year.
Failed his first year exams.
Yep. He was pretty blunt about it later, just said he had no ambitions to do it. Knew almost immediately it wasn't for him. The real shift, the pivot back towards performance, came after seeing a play.
Let me guess, Pat Kiernan again.
You got it. Kiernan's production of A Clockwork Orange, that seems to have really solidified things for him. But even then, when he first got involved with the UCC Drama Society, his motives weren't exactly pure artistic striving at first.
What was it then?
He actually admitted his main reason for joining was, and I quote, to go to parties and meet women. Even though he ended up getting lead roles, like in Little Shop of Horrors.
That's hilarious and so relatable, actually, for someone who became known for such serious, intense roles.
Totally. But that initial, maybe more casual motivation, it obviously shifted pretty quickly once he really committed to the craft itself, once he really felt that power of live performance again.
Okay, so music's out. Law school's definitely out. Parties and women maybe took a back seat because suddenly acting is the focus. And once he decided, it sounds like he went all in, back to Pat Kiernan.
Yep, determined. The sources say he basically kept pressuring Kiernan until he finally got an audition with Corkadorka. That persistence paid off.
And that landed him his professional debut.
September 1996. A play by Enda Walsh called Disco Pigs. He played this really volatile Cork teenager, Pig. Apparently, Enda Walsh saw something special right away, called him incredibly enigmatic, said he had real presence.
And Disco Pigs, that wasn't just a small local run, was it?
No, not at all. It was only meant to run for 3 weeks in Cork initially, but it just took off. Ended up touring for 2 solid years, Europe, Canada, Australia, the whole thing.
Wow, so that was it then, the point of no return.
Pretty much. That tour meant he had to officially leave university, had to leave mm-hmm. the band behind. Theater became everything. It was his drama school, effectively. He just kept working on stage, Much Ado About Nothing in 98, Juno and the Paycock in 99.
And critics started noticing him?
Yeah, they started pointing out his subtlety, his intelligence on stage. There was a play called The Shape of Things in 2002 where he got praised for impressive subtlety and intelligence. That stage discipline is so important for understanding his later film work. He learned that intense focus there.
And the jump from stage to screen, it happened pretty quickly after that, and it was big.
Huge. His first major screen role wasn't some small Irish indie film. It was Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later,
mm-hmm.
a massive genre-bending horror film that came out in 2002.
How did that casting happen off the back of the stage work?
Directly, yeah. The casting director, Gail Stevens, she'd seen him in Disco Pigs. She recommended him to Boyle. She apparently noted his physicality, that slightly sort of drained, almost dreamy quality he had, which was perfect for Jim, the guy waking from a coma into this empty, terrifying London.
Right, Jim. Waking up to, oh, chaos. And there's that story about him appearing nude early in the film.
Yeah, the sources mention that. Apparently, it wasn't just for shock value. The decision was actually based on how slender, almost frail, he looked on set. The production team felt his physique really sold the vulnerability of someone just waking up after weeks in a hospital.
Interesting detail. And the film itself, huge impact.
Oh, massive. It became this unexpected global hit in 2003. Suddenly, Cillian Murphy was visible to a huge international audience. And he wasn't afraid to claim the film's significance either. He later said something like, "We were the first people to make zombies run. And that changed everything."
Which is kind of true, actually. It did revitalize that genre.
Totally. Put him right in the spotlight. But at the same time, while this horror hit was exploding, he was still doing Irish films.
Like Intermission with Colin Farrell.
Exactly. Intermission in 2003. He played this sort of down on his luck supermarket worker involved in a heist. A mix of comedy and crime.
And that film did really well in Ireland, didn't it?
Yeah, for a while it was the highest grossing Irish independent film ever. Which shows he could carry a local production, too. Critics really liked his range in it, praised his fluent ease, that graceful and wholly believable intensity. He could be the zombie apocalypse survivor 1 minute and this kind of sad sack Dublin guy the next.
So his profile's rising, Hollywood starts calling, but maybe with smaller parts.
Right. Supporting roles, but memorable ones. Roles that got him seen without him having to, like, sell his soul to the studio system just yet.
Like what?
Well, he played a butcher in Girl with a Pearl Earring in 2003, and then a deserting soldier in Cold Mountain, also 2003. That was a huge movie, obviously.
Cold Mountain, yeah. Big epic.
Massive. Yep. But he said he was only actually on location in Romania for about a week for his part. So these were kind of strategic appearances, you know? Dip a toe in the big Hollywood pond, let people see him, learn how those huge productions work, but then step back, still protecting that autonomy.
Okay, let's talk about 2005. Because this year feels absolutely pivotal. It kind of cemented his image for playing these incredible villains. And crucially, it's the start of that massive collaboration with Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, 2005 is huge. And it all kicks off with Batman Begins. The story there is almost legend now, right?
Mm-hmm.
He actually auditioned for Bruce Wayne, for Batman himself.
Knowing he probably wouldn't get it.
Exactly. He knew he didn't have the, you know, the physical build for the traditional superhero type. He was leaner. More intense.
But Nolan saw something else.
Totally. Nolan was apparently blown away, not by his Bruce Wayne, but just by his presence on screen, his intensity. So Nolan specifically cast him as Dr. Jonathan Crane, the Scarecrow, a villain whose threat is much more psychological.
And Nolan really focused on his eyes, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. There's that great quote from Nolan in Spin magazine where he said Murphy had the most extraordinary eyes. And he loved them so much, he apparently kept inventing reasons in the script for Scarecrow to take his glasses off in close-ups, just to get those eyes on camera.
That's amazing. A director literally changing shots to feature an actor's eyes.
It shows you how striking that feature was and how central it became to his screen persona, especially for villains. And then, if Batman Begins introduced those intense eyes, the other big film from 2005, Red Eye, really put them to work.
Ah, the Wes Craven thriller, On the Plane with Rachel McAdams.
That's the one. He plays Jackson Ribner, this charming but utterly terrifying guy, and the critics just latched onto it. The New York Times reviewer wrote his baby blues look cold enough to freeze water. Chilling stuff.
And Red Eye was a big hit financially too, right?
Yeah, made nearly $100 million worldwide. So that really solidified him in the public mind as this compelling, intelligent, maybe slightly unsettling villain.
He was definitely having a moment. Entertainment Weekly called him one of their summer MVPs. The New Yorker said he was one of the most elegantly seductive monsters in recent movies.
Elegantly seductive. That's key, isn't it? It wasn't just scary. There was a charisma there, an intelligence that made the characters really compelling, really dangerous.
But here's the Cillian Murphy signature move again, right? It's just as he's being typecast as the perfect villain, he does a complete 180.
Exactly. In the same year, 2005, he takes on this incredibly different, incredibly vulnerable role in Breakfast on Pluto, playing Patrick, or Kitten, Braden, a transgender Irish woman searching for her mother in London during the Troubles.
Talk about transformation. That must have been a huge leap from Scarecrow and Jackson Ribner.
A massive leap. And it was a role he really wanted. He'd apparently been lobbying the director, Neil Jordan, for years to play Kitten. Shows that same persistence we saw earlier with theater auditions. When he wants a part, he goes after it.
And the preparation for Kitten must have been intense.
Oh, totally immersive. Yeah. The sources say he met with a transvestite who actually dressed him up, took him out clubbing in character. So he was really living it, in a way. Plus all the physical stuff. He called it serious primping. Makeup, hair removal, getting his eyebrows plucked, really committing to embodying Kitten's specific kind of flamboyant yet quite fragile persona.
And did that gamble, that willingness to completely shed the villain image, pay off?
Big time. He got his first Golden Globe nomination for it, for Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy. And he won the Best Actor Award at the Irish Film and Television Academy Awards. It absolutely demonstrated his range. It proved he wasn't just going to take the easy route and keep playing villains after his breakout success. Transformation was the goal.
So 2005 is villainy and transformation. What about 2006?
2006 brings another huge and very different landmark role. The Wind That Shakes the Barley, directed by Ken Loach.
Ah, the Irish War of Independence film. That must have been incredibly meaningful for him.
Deeply personal, yeah. It was filmed in County Cork, where he grew up. He played Damien O'Donovan, a young docker who gives up his career to join the IRA and fight for independence, only to end up on the opposing side to his own brother during the Civil War. He auditioned 6 times for that role.
6 times, wow.
Yeah, he really wanted it. He called it a very special privilege to be part of it because of that connection to Cork and the history.
And the fame itself was huge, critically.
Immense. He won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, the top prize. And back home in Ireland, it actually broke the box office record that Intermission had set. Yeah, became the most successful Irish independent film ever at the time.
And his performance, how is that received?
Really well. Critics noted how he captured both the idealism, the zealotry even, of the revolution, but also the devastating soul-searching and the regret that came with the conflict, especially the Civil War aspect. It showed he could carry a film based purely on that complex internal struggle. He won GQ's Actor of the Year Award in 2006 for it. So by the end of 2006, he'd proven everything. Stage chops, blockbuster villain, transformative character actor, and leading man in a serious historical drama. The range was undeniable. So after that intense period, say 2005, 2006, Murphy really enters this next phase, maybe the late 2000s into the early 2010s, where he's consolidating his position. He's a known quantity, a respected actor, and he's continuing these key collaborations while still seeking out interesting, complex roles.
Right, like continuing the Nolan connection. He wasn't done with Scarecrow quite yet.
No, he popped up again briefly in The Dark Knight in 2008, and then again for a third time in The Dark Knight Rises in 2012. It was almost like he was Nolan's little signature, you know, a familiar face turning up, often causing a bit of trouble.
He also worked with Danny Boyle again, didn't he, after 28 Days Later?
Yeah, they reunited for the sci-fi film Sunshine in 2007. He played a physicist, part of a crew trying to reignite the sun. And that role apparently had quite a personal impact on him.
How so?
Well, he mentioned that researching the physics, thinking about the vastness of space and the universe for the role, it actually shifted his own views towards atheism. Though he did add that his Catholic upbringing still kind of formed his moral compass, which is an interesting balance.
And then, of course, another huge Nolan film. Inception in 2010, he played Robert Fisher, the heir whose mind is the target of the whole operation.
Right. So he's consistently in these massive, high-profile films.
Right.
But, and this is typical Murphy, he's also doing these other much smaller, maybe more unconventional things alongside them. Things that seem driven by artistic curiosity or even national pride.
Like the postage stamp.
Exactly. In 2008, Ireland put him on an actual postage stamp for his role in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. How cool is that?
Very cool. And didn't he do a silent short film around then too?
Yeah. The Wider in 2009 was only 15 minutes long, almost entirely silent. And he specifically said doing that, acting without dialogue, was the hardest test for any actor.
Uh-huh.
Again, seeking the challenge, not necessarily the big paycheck or the exposure.
And he kept returning to the stage as well, right? Keeping those roots strong.
Absolutely. Theater seems to be his creative reset button. In 2011, he did this incredibly demanding one-man show called Mr. Men, written by Enda Walsh again, the writer of Disco Pigs.
A one-man show. That sounds intense.
Hugely intense. He played multiple characters, all quite disturbed and complex. He talked about how the live nature of it makes theater so dangerous, which is clearly something that excites him. He won a Drama Desk Award for that performance. It proved his stage skills were as sharp as ever.
And speaking of intense experiences, 2012 brought Red Lights, working with Robert De Niro.
Ah, the De Niro moment, as you called it earlier, yeah. Murphy's reflections on that are really telling about how he sees acting, and maybe himself.
He found it intimidating.
Completely. He basically said, there was no acting involved on my part. The man has presence. You can't act presence. He was in awe of De Niro's natural gravitas.
So what does that tell us?
Well, it suggests a difference in approach, maybe. De Niro have that legendary star power, that inherent De Niro-ness.
Yeah.
Murphy seems to see his own strength, not in projecting Cillian Murphy-ness, but in disappearing, in transforming into the character. Working with De Niro probably just reinforced his own path, prioritized the internal work, the chameleon act, over relying on just being present.
Which leads us perfectly into the role that probably made him a global household name more than any other. Thomas Shelby.
Tommy Shelby, yeah.
Yeah.
Peaky Blinders, starting in 2013. Just iconic.
And the story behind him getting that role is fantastic, too. It wasn't a given, was it?
No, not at all. The show's creator, Stephen Knight, apparently had Jason Statham in mind first. You know, thinking about the physicality, the obvious toughness needed for a Birmingham gang leader, Statham has that in spades.
But Murphy wanted it.
He did. And he got it. By basically reminding Knight what acting is all about. He sent that now legendary text message to Knight.
Remember, I'm an actor.
Boom. That's it. It's like his whole career philosophy distilled into four words. Don't look at my physique. Look at my ability to become the person you need.
And become him, he did. He described Shelby as so rich and complex, layered and contradictory. What did it take to embody him?
A lot. There was the voice, nailing that specific Birmingham accent. There was the haircut, obviously. But also a significant physical transformation.
Right, because Murphy had been a vegetarian for a long time before that.
Yeah, for about 15 years. He had initially stopped eating meat, partly over concerns about mad cow disease, but also generally about agribusiness practices. It was a long-held principle.
But he started eating meat again for Tommy Shelby.
He did. Specifically to bulk up, to gain muscle mass, and achieve that more imposing physical presence the role required.
Yeah.
He needed to look like someone who could genuinely lead a feared street gang. That's incredible dedication, changing a core personal habit purely for a character.
Did he stick with it after the show?
No, apparently not. The sources confirm he went back to being vegetarian once Peaky Blinders finished filming in 2022. So the meat eating was purely part of the Shelby transformation toolkit.
Amazing commitment. And the show itself obviously became this massive cultural phenomenon, ran until 2022, really cemented his status worldwide.
Absolutely. But even while being the face of this huge show, he was still exploring other creative outlets. He didn't just sit back.
Like directing.
Yeah, in 2013, he actually directed a music video for a band called Money for their single Hold Me Forever. Shows the music interest never really went away completely.
And he hosts a radio show, too.
He does. Since 2020, he's had this show on BBC Radio 6 Music called Cillian Murphy's Limited Edition. It's a limited series where he basically just plays music from his own collection, talks about it, sometimes answers listener questions. It's a very controlled way for him to share a bit of his personality on his own terms, focusing on something he loves.
So managing to stay busy, stay creative, stay relatively private, even while playing one of the most recognizable TV characters of the decade. And we know the Shelby story isn't totally over yet, right?
Nope. He's set to reprise the role in the upcoming Peaky Blinders movie sequel, which is apparently titled The Immortal Man. So Tommy will write again.
So all this incredible work, the stage, the indie films, the transformations, the iconic TV role, it all leads really to 2023. And Oppenheimer. The absolute peak, you could argue.
It really felt like everything aligning, didn't it? His sixth film with Christopher Nolan after nearly two decades of collaboration. But this time, finally, the lead role, the central performance.
And Nolan clearly had immense faith in him to carry it. He called him the film's pulsing nucleus.
And Murphy just delivered with that typical intensity and dedication. The preparation was immense. We heard about the significant weight loss, really aiming for Oppenheimer's documented near-emaciated appearance during that period.
And the research, too. He really dove into understanding the man.
Mm.
And apparently took some visual cues from David Bowie.
Yeah, isn't that a great detail?
Yeah.
Using Bowie's look from the 1970s as inspiration for Oppenheimer's kind of ethereal, super-intelligent, almost otherworldly presence. A really interesting creative choice.
And the result? Well, historic. The film made almost $1 billion worldwide, and his performance led to that clean sweep of the major awards. Oscar, Golden Globe, BAFTA, SAG Award, just undeniable. He went from respected character actor to a bona fide, world-beating leading man.
But here's where it gets really interesting, and where you see that core philosophy kick in again. What does he do immediately after reaching the absolute summit of acting recognition?
He focuses on control, on production.
Exactly. February 2024, he launches his own independent production company, Big Things Films, with his producing partner, Alan Maloney.
It's like the echo of that 19-year-old turning down their record deal, isn't it? It's always about controlling the work, the output.
Precisely. He's achieved the highest level of success as an actor, so the next logical step for him isn't just more acting, it's gaining control over the entire process, from developing the script to starring in it. It's about longevity and autonomy, not just basking in the Oscar glow.
And the company's already active.
Oh, yeah. They produce small things like these, which he also starred in. That film opened the Berlin Film Festival earlier this year. It's a smaller-scale, historical Irish drama, exactly the kind of meaningful project you'd expect him to champion.
Mm.
And there's another drama called Sleeve in the Works, too.
But maybe the most telling move in terms of taking control of his own narrative is returning to 28 Days Later.
Right. He's not just starring in the sequels, 28 Years Later and 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple. He's also an executive producer on them.
So he's using his current star power, his Oppenheimer clout, to go back and have a real stake in the franchise that first gave him that big international break over 20 years ago.
It perfectly encapsulates his journey, doesn't it?
Mm.
The transformations lead to success, and that success is immediately reinvested into gaining more creative power and independence. It's a very smart, very consistent approach.
Which brings us back full circle to that central paradox. this immense artistic achievement on one hand and this incredibly private, guarded public persona on the other. Even now, as an Oscar winner, he seems allergic to the whole celebrity circus.
Completely. He openly talks about finding red carpets and that whole side of things a challenge.
Mm.
He's basically engineered his life to be uninteresting to tabloids.
What was that quote? Something about not creating controversy.
Yeah, he put it very bluntly. I haven't created any controversy. I don't sleep around. I don't go and fall down drunk. Essentially saying, there's nothing for you gossip writers here. Move along. By being deliberately low-key in his personal life, he starves the beast.
And it's not a recent thing either. He avoided the limelight for years. Didn't he wait ages to even go on a TV talk show?
Yeah. The sources say his first TV talk show appearance wasn't until 2010 on Ireland's Late Late Show. That's 7 years after 28 Days Later made him internationally known, and 5 years after he was Scarecrow in Batman Begins. That's commitment to privacy.
And he seems genuinely detached from the whole internet culture, too. The meme thing.
The disappointed Cillian Murphy meme, which came about just because he often looks quite serious or thoughtful in interviews.
And when someone finally asked him about it in 2017...
His response was apparently, what's a meme? Just completely, genuinely unaware that he was a viral internet thing.
That's almost performance art in itself, to reach that level of fame while being that disconnected.
It really is. And yet, despite or maybe because of this reserved intensity, he's still seen as this major style figure. He was named one of GQ's best-dressed men. And just this year, 2024, announced as the face of Versace. Go figure. An unconventional sex symbol.
So he maintains this status, but very much on his own terms. And outside of film, his public activities seem quite focused, too, like his activism.
Yeah, it's not scattered. He was involved in Rock the Vote in Ireland back in 2007. He does ongoing work advocating for the homeless with Focus Ireland. He's been a patron for a UNESCO research center focused on children and families since 2011.
And he took a pretty strong public stance on the abortion referendum in Ireland in 2018.
He did. He actively supported the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment, even specifically appealed to men to vote yes. So when it's an issue he feels strongly about, he is willing to use his platform, breaking that usual silence.
And personally, he seems to have maintained that stability too, married since 2004.
Yeah, to Yvonne McGuinness. They actually met way back in 1996 at one of his band's gigs. They lived in London for about 14 years, but then moved back to Dublin in 2015. Raising their two sons there, presumably a bit further away from the intense media glare you'd get in London or L.A.
Okay, so if we step back and look at the whole arc, from that quirk teenager trying to keep control of his song rights, through all the demanding stage work, the film transformations, the iconic roles, right up to the absolute peak with Oppenheimer, it's quite a ride.
It's an incredible narrative of range, isn't it? The subtlety on stage, the raw emotion in the wind that shakes the barley, the physical transformation for Tommy Shelby, the intellectual depth of Oppenheimer.
And it feels like that Oscar wasn't just for one role, but recognition for decades of that consistent, challenging, transformative work. Always choosing the interesting path, the artistic challenge, whether it was playing Kit and Braden or Jim the Survivor, or Scarecrow over just chasing fame or easy roles.
Definitely. And for you, the listener, I think the big takeaway from all this source material is pretty powerful. It shows that maybe the most impactful, long-lasting careers aren't built on chasing the spotlight. They're built on integrity, on curiosity, and on fiercely protecting your creative autonomy, your ability to choose the work that matters to you. Murphy's living proof you can reach the very top while staying fundamentally detached from the celebrity machine.
Absolutely. So let's leave you with a final thought to chew on based on everything we've discussed.
Okay. Consider this. Cillian Murphy reaches the absolute pinnacle. He wins the Best Actor Oscar for embodying J. Robert Oppenheimer, arguably one of the most complex leading roles imaginable. What does he do next?
He pivots immediately to producing. He stars in smaller, independent historical dramas like Small Things Like These. And he decides to return as a producer and star to the sci-fi horror franchise that launched him 20 years ago, 28 Days Later.
So the question is, what does that trajectory tell us? Does it suggest that for an artist like Murphy, the real deep dive isn't just about mastering one huge role, however significant?
Is it maybe more about constantly seeking new challenges, new forms of creative control, new ways to discover things long after the awards are on the shelf? Something for you to think about until our next deep dive.